Do you suffer from internal dialogue that often criticizes yourself? Today, we're going to be exploring the role of your inner critic, what it is, why it's there, and what you can do about it so that you can experience things differently in your life. If you'd like to find out more about how you can improve your relationships or how to find and develop a fulfilling relationship, head over to therelationshipmaze.com where we have lots of resources and our online relationship course, The Relationship Maze, to take a real deep dive into your relationships and what you can do to improve them and make them far more fulfilling. You can also take our free online conflict style quiz and discover your conflict style in relationships. And press subscribe to this podcast right now. Welcome to today's episode of The Relationship Maze, and today we're talking about the inner critic.
Mine is very frequently alive. How about yours?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the inner critic can be useful, but for many of us, it's that constant jabbering dialogue of, why did I do that? Yeah. Why didn't you do this?
How stupid of you.
What an idiot you are for doing that.
Yeah.
The sort of things that we'd never say to anybody else, but we say them to ourselves continuously.
Mm. Yeah, and it can be more or less strong, this voice, can't it? So this inner critic is this inner voice that you have that offers you this running commentary on what you have done, how you have done. And usually, I mean, you know, we can have a positive inner critic that tells us, well done, that was really great. But a lot of the time, the voice that is really very strong is the one that tells you that you haven't done so well, that you should have done differently, that people will think, often people will think that you are, you know, you haven't done that well, something like that. So it's always this very harsh voice that we have internalized that tells us off. And it can be really uncomfortable, right?
Absolutely. And just to pick up on a point, you know, the word critic doesn't mean negative in itself.
No.
So when you read a critique, for example, a play, it could be very positive. Mm-hmm. So a critic could be useful. It could be information we use as feedback. But the problem is, a lot of the time, it's not particularly useful.
Mm.
It's just sort of negative criticism or negative kind of feedback, which isn't accurate.
Mm.
It's a distortion.
Mm.
So, you know, every time you go out and you have that inner dialogue that says, I'm not attractive enough. People won't like me. You're going to an interview and thinking, this is going to go badly. I'm just going to fail it.
Mm.
How does that feel?
Mm.
You know, it doesn't feel good. And when we have that sort of feeling that, you know, there's negative, well, what we might label as negative emotions, we go in with more anxiety into a situation, we're likely not to do as well. And that can in turn actually reinforce the critic, because we may not get that interview. We may not have a successful first date.
Mm-hmm.
Because I mean, this happens a lot in dating as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go out on a first date and thinking, oh, my hair isn't right, or, you know, they're never going to find me attractive. And sure enough, because of that, we don't project ourselves in the way that leads the other person to feel that maybe we're friendly even.
Mm-hmm.
There's some people who normally with friends, for example, are very friendly, very kind of can be very happy, very kind of, you know, wonderful people to be with. When they're meeting somebody new, they may just clam up. And the other person may have that experience of this person, for example, as being cold or not interested.
Mm-hmm.
When in fact, it's that they're nervous because they think that the other person won't find them attractive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all because of this inner critic that's jabbering in the head.
Mm. So, yeah, so it's worth maybe first of all exploring where is this coming from? What is this inner critic? And then we can think about what to do with it. So obviously, again, it's kind of to some extent, it's kind of material that you have taken in through experiences. I mean, you might have had a lot of negative experiences. You might have had a lot of experiences where people have told you that you haven't done something very well. So sometimes it's based in very concrete experiences that you had where somebody told you off about something or told you it wasn't that great. A lot of the time, it's more abstract than that. It's very often because there is a part of you that that hasn't been formed enough to to counter-react to the inner critic, so to speak, another part of you that can do the soothing, that can tell the inner critic, no, actually, it's all right, it's not that bad, that can, you know, that can kind of do away with the strong inner critical voice. If that part hasn't developed very well, then obviously the critical voice is stronger and louder. And that can be because, you know, you might have had very critical parents, or you might have been at a school where you had quite authoritarian teachers who questioned, you know, your abilities to learn something all of the time. So a lot of the time it is grounded in these kind of earlier experiences. Would you agree, or is it something else?
Well, I mean, I would argue that all of your inner critic is grounded in your experiences.
Sure.
I don't see how it can't be. I mean, I think that, yeah. And that's the thing, is that when you were born, when you were like lying in your kind of crib at sort of 3 months old, you weren't lying there thinking, no one's ever going to find me attractive.
No one's going
to
love
me. I'm never going to be able to do maths.
Yes.
Or, you know, or even, oh, I don't know about this walking thing, but I'm going to have to learn. I'm not going to be able to do that. You know, these are things that you learn later on.
Mm-hmm.
So we learn that, we internalize them, maybe because we had critical parents, but not always.
Not always.
It may be to do with the whole dynamic in a family. Mm-hmm. It may be to do with dynamics of, like you said, at school and early experiences, mm-hmm. that are significant.
Or
a combination of all of them.
Mm-hmm.
So you may have very supportive parents. Mm-hmm. However, because of other experiences, maybe at school or mm-hmm. with sort of other people that you met, even at nursery, who mm-hmm. maybe treated you in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Then you start to interpret what your parents say as being critical when it's not. I've experienced this with quite a few people.
Mm-hmm.
That parents, well, when someone describes what their parents used to say, you could also interpret that in a completely different way.
Mm-hmm.
However, the interpretation has come because of all of these different things that come together. But I think the really important key is you learn that inner critic, that it's learned, it's conditioned from an early age. That we start to kind of form these beliefs about ourselves, which then lead to this internal dialogue. But it's not that you were born with it.
No, I mean, very often, a lot of it goes back to really early days and early attachment. So if a child hasn't attached securely to their parents, if they haven't sort of felt that they are loved by their parents for whatever reasons, because the parents were emotionally absent, were preoccupied with something else, with job losses, troubles in their relationship or whatever, the parents weren't quite fully there for the children, that does get internalized as the child thinking that they're not ultimately lovable. And with that not being lovable comes also the sense of not being fully accepted, having a sense that develops that is not fully accepted. And that then transposes onto all sorts of experiences and relationships, the sense of that I'm not really the person who can do things very well, because I'm ultimately not the right, I'm not a person who anyone wants to be with, get things right, etc. So there's very often there are very complex experiences early on in infancy at play that make a child develop a much stronger inner critic than others. But it's not, as you say, it's not only always about the family home. It's about schooling. I think schooling is hugely important. And I think that particularly at the moment, children are brought up to pay a lot of attention to their achievements at school, their academic achievements. There's huge amount of pressure, I think more so than when I was at school, arguably. And that can create such a strong strain for many children, and they kind of feel like they're not good enough, they're not getting the grades that are expected of them. They see other kids doing much better at school. So they also then develop this kind of sense of, well, I'm not good enough, really. I can never do anything well enough.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, interestingly, the attachment side that mm-hmm. you said is some of this is pre-verbal.
Sure.
And we learn it in a somatic way, is that if we don't get those needs met, we may feel anxious, for example, when our carer leaves the room, or leaves, you know, but isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
When we start to develop language, we have those somatic responses. We have that feeling, we have the automatic response that's been, basically stored within our central nervous system. And then we start to put words onto it. So we start to kind of interpret what's going on. I'm feeling this anxiety. It must be because X, Y, and Z. So we start to then produce that narrative to almost explain those responses that we're having internally. Mm-hmm. And we can do that in many different ways. So it's even pre-verbal that some of this starts, just like you said. Mm-hmm. But I think in terms of schooling, I know certainly when I was at school, I think there was a huge amount. And I think sometimes it's easy. A lot of people don't remember actually how much pressure there was. I think there's always been pressure.
Yeah.
Maybe it's different in Germany. I don't know.
But, no, I think it was a lot more relaxed, actually.
But also, when I was at school, there was the difference in terms of if you were anxious, you just get on with it. You just basically, you're not allowed to talk about the fact that you're feeling like this. It wasn't recognised. Whereas now there's a lot more recognition for some of these things that are happening. Mm. There was no recognition of if people needed extra help. Mm-hmm. Whereas now, you know, I think that there are different supports and resources available. So it's changed. There's a lot of pressure. I think there's always a lot of pressure.
Okay, so maybe it hasn't changed. Who knows? I mean,
yeah, it's just different.
I haven't got any data. I'm just sort of, talking about this anecdotally. And you're right, I think that pressure has always been there.
Yeah.
I think ultimately it's just... Sorry.
No, but I think the thing that's really changed now is the internet and social media.
Right. Yeah.
Because all of that criticism that's out there, and I've experienced this with younger clients where, you know, social media and that negative feedback, the trolling, you write something, there's a criticism about how you look, about you're not intelligent. And sitting behind a computer, people can just write anything. But there's this then internalization about what your peers think, which can then become that really challenging in a dialogue, which we carry forwards. So I think that's the extra piece that is really challenging in the kind of, you know, right now.
I agree with you, because it gets magnified, doesn't it? It goes into a much bigger room, so to speak, and everyone can see it, and everyone gives their own feedback, etc. So yeah, so this inner critic, what do we do with it? That's the sort of question here. So we, you know, there are many reasons why we have it, and I think arguably we all have, to a larger or smaller extent, we have some sort of inner critic. But with some people, it's louder, it's more frequent, it's there all of the time. It's really troublesome, this constant inner voice that tells them I'm not good enough.
Yeah.
So what do we do with it?
Well, I think, you know, ultimately, going for psychotherapy or counselling is going to be a really important step. Mm-hmm. We have our course, The Relationship Maze, which, although it's aimed mainly at relationships, the first module of a couple of modules goes a lot into your own internal thinking and thought patterns and challenging that. Mm-hmm. And you can find that at therelationshipmaze.com. Mm-hmm. And we go into a lot of depth with that. Mm-hmm. I think an approach that's a really wonderful approach with this as well, which, like I said, I think going to having a personal therapy is important to explore where it comes from and work on the beliefs that are formed around this. Acceptance and commitment therapy, I find, is a wonderful way of having a different relationship with that dialogue. So it's ACT, it's called. Mm-hmm. And I think one thing that's important is to recognize it for what it is. It's like that voice. It is a voice. It's not you. It's almost like a conditioned response. Mm-hmm. So if I was to, for example, go 1, 2, 3, what does your mind automatically go to? For most people, you're going to think 4. Mm-hmm. Because we automatically have that response. So Mary had a little, we fill in the gap. If you know that nursery rhyme. Mm-hmm. So that's conditioned. It's almost impossible not to think of those things. We start to recognize our internal dialogue is a little bit like that, that we go into a situation and almost automatically that thought pops into our head. Adding the words, I'm having the thought in front of that thought, is a great way to recognize it as a thought. Mm-hmm. That thoughts are part of your experience, but you're more than those individual thoughts. Mm-hmm. And hearing that dialogue, almost like as a radio station, it's just playing in the shop. Like you go into a shop and it's playing music that you don't like. Mm-hmm. You get on with your shopping and you just hear that in the background. Mm-hmm. Hearing those thoughts, hearing those and recognize them, or seeing the thoughts, because sometimes it's what we picture. Mm-hmm. Seeing them or hearing them for what they are, which is thoughts, like internal dialogue. Recognizing that that's something that's learned, but it's not you, can help you begin to detach from it. And in ACT, it's called diffusing. Mm-hmm. So when we're fused to a thought, It's like we become emotionally entrenched in that thought. Mm-hmm. It's like that thought is us, that thought is the world. But when we defuse, we see the thought as a thought. So that basically means that we see, start to see the world as it is, and not as the, so we see the world as it is and not as your mind tells you that it is.
Mm-hmm. And that's such an important distinction, isn't it? Mm. So I like a lot of the diffusion techniques in ACT. We've talked about some of them before, which kind of enable you to create that distinction, to become a bit more aware of that. This is not the whole of you. This is a part of you. This is a voice that is telling you. It's a thought, as you say, that is telling you to believe a certain reality. So one way, for example, that I really like about actually ACT, but it comes from Gestalt therapy, I think, originally, is this idea of you give this inner critic a voice, a very concrete voice. You name it, you give it a name, you make it a character. So, for example, you know, if it's a very tyrannical voice, it could be the voice of a tyrannical character in literature or a film. So Aunt Lydia in The Handmaid's Tale is a good example. She's horrible, isn't she? She commandeers you around and tells you that you're not worth anything. So create a name from fiction, from a song, from a film that you associate with being particularly dictatorial and tyrannical. That is your inner critic. That kind of creates a little bit more detachment here from, and also highlights that this is a particular voice that is raised in that moment. Do you try that sometimes?
I think that can be a really good idea. But one thing I'd urge caution with is by giving it a name of somebody that you think is a bad person.
Okay.
Because this voice comes from within you. So if you label that voice as being sort of like an evil person from history, mm-hmm. then essentially you're saying that in your mind, within you, you have this evil quality. Mm-hmm.
That's true.
Because it comes from within you. So I think having a label that some you can think, oh yeah, there's that inner dictator, there's that Bart Simpson voice, but not making fun of it.
Yeah.
But just in terms of you can then step back, but not have an overly strong attachment again to that character.
Okay, yeah.
Because I think, again, that starts to say that we may have bad qualities ourselves. And, you know, it's trying to kind of recognize that we learn these things, mm. not through anything that's bad or good. We just learn them.
Mm. Yeah.
And, you know, everything we do, all of our behaviours, we've learned. Mm. And some of them we may feel ashamed by, and which are guided by that, you know, sometimes that internal dialogue. But at the time we learn them because we may have modelled somebody, we may have learned them thinking that's the best option.
Mm.
But I think sometimes when we get attached to behaviours as being good or bad, we may see ourselves as good or bad, and we have that sense of shame, but just seeing them as behaviours that we've learned. So trying to detach from that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But that's the challenge, and that's easily said, but not so easily done, right?
No, and I think that's why, you know, sometimes, but some of that inner dialogue, you need to go through the course of having therapy.
Mm.
Because sometimes you need to do more than kind of just think, okay, there's the inner dictator, there's the internal Bart Simpson.
Yeah.
Because we can also give your voice of that internal dialogue a different quality,
mm-hmm.
which is leads on from what you've said.
Mm-hmm.
So we might think, okay, you've got that voice that says, oh, I'm never going to do well at this. And think, okay, who's a cartoon character that when you hear them, you know, it just makes you smile at it? Like Bart Simpson.
Yeah, so
and so it'd be like, okay, I'm never going to do well at this. I can't do Bart Simpson. But it's sort of like hearing it as that character. So when you hear it, it just kind of, it takes away the meaning. Because that internal critic, usually when you're saying those things to yourself, you're not saying them in a supportive tone of voice, in a loving tone of voice. It's in that sort of, you're never going to be any good at this.
Mm-hmm.
But if you give it a different tonality, it takes away some of that quality. So think about, how would this sound differently if it was said slowly or fast? If it was said like Mickey Mouse.
Or in a funny accent.
Yeah, in a funny accent.
Mm.
Yeah.
Or sometimes another technique I sometimes suggest is that you sing it.
Yeah.
You sing the, I'm never gonna be good enough, something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's another technique that talks about in ACT as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think Stephen Hayes, the founder of ACT, that's what I'm talking, I think in some of, one of his books, he even suggests singing it's a happy birthday if you can't think of anything else.
Yeah.
So you just sing that voice, sing those words out loud. Mm. So it helps diffuse. And that's not that it's going to take away the things forever, but it helps detach at that time. Mm. And over time, you can then start to kind of relate to it differently. You start to recognize it as it's just that voice.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it from my experience, it can require a bit of time. This doesn't happen overnight, particularly if you're... If your inner critic is really, really powerful and constantly raises its head, it does require quite a lot of challenges. It's almost like, you know, constant reality testing. Is this really true, what I'm assuming here? Is this really the case that I'm not doing well enough? It's kind of going through the situations again and again and realizing, well, actually, that's a really harsh way of judging this. This requires some practice to really look at it, as you just say, as just a thought.
Yeah, and I think that's the difference in ACTS. Well, in acceptance and commitment therapy, it's not about even challenging it. Mm-hmm. It's about just hearing it as a voice, which is difficult to do. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the challenges is when you've said these things to yourself enough, when you've developed that inner critic, underneath that lies core beliefs, so beliefs about yourself. So you might say, well, you know, nobody's going to find me attractive, but underneath is a deep belief that inherently you might believe that you're unlovable. Mm-hmm. And that's something that might only come out through therapy and over time exploring ways to process that differently, to kind of get a different sense of yourself, to kind of experience that actually it's not that you're unlovable. That's something, again, that you've learned through the environments and context that you grew up in. And that can take work. So just changing the internal dialogue may not do that, but it's a start.
It's a start, yeah. It's just something to try and experiment with.
Yeah. And for those ones that really stick, finding a therapist that you can work with is going to be really helpful with this.
But it can be, also a word of optimism here, it can really be challenged. My experience is that this is something that you might, you know, somebody who has got a very, very, very strong inner critic, they might never be the super duper confident person, but they can really change significantly in that regard and be much less harsh to themselves and much kinder and more, you know, more just developing a different relationship with themselves, a more positive relationship. So I think it can be done. There's no doubt in my mind.
Yeah, and actually part of that, I think, is taking away the beliefs or expectations about what being confident is. Because when you can never be a super confident person. Well, what is confidence?
Well, that's a
confidence, if I, you know, if I said, okay, just close the window, could you open the door? You just go and open the door. You don't think about it. That's, to me, is actually what confidence is. It's where you do something without having to have that internal doubt. So I think confidence is a lot of the time just not having to be pulled into that internal critic. So it's not about jumping up and down and saying, yeah, you can rule the world or whatever. It's much more subtle than that. And I think actually everyone can experience that.
Yeah.
And it starts from diffusing from that internal critic, from that internal monologue, sometimes an internal dialogue, I guess, if you internalize more than one person.
I mean, absolutely. People can write reams of pages about that inner dialogue that happens there. A lot.
Yeah, because you might start saying, actually, I can do this. Then suddenly the other voice, no, you can't.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, it might be, again, it might be quite helpful to write that down to just sort of get some sense of when you catch yourself. Because first of all, it's also learning to kind of really listen to that voice, noticing what it's saying to you. When you catch that, it might be quite helpful to externalize it, to take it out of you by putting it on paper, writing it down, getting some sense of, oh, actually, this is interesting. You know, this is what I'm telling myself here. Isn't that extraordinary?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great idea. So start to journal it. We're going to wrap up this episode, so please tune in again next week. Head over to therelationshipmaze.com, where we have our course, The Relationship Maze, which goes into a deep dive into yourself. Although it's aimed at developing relationships, there's a huge amount in the first couple of modules that help you explore yourself in a lot of depth and how you can change.